Ooh.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey. Am I coming in okay?
Yep, am I?
Yep.
Hey. Have I heard to unmute my mic? I think I have.
Yeah, but you sound like you're talking through a tin can.
Is that better?
Oh,
there much you go. Better.
There you go. Okay, it might help if I pull the headset part of it that I talk into. Might help if I pull it down.
So how's everyone doing?
Very well.
Okay.
How are you, Tracy? Is your throat still killing you?
Yeah.
Well, that sucks.
Are you taking the regular hot toddies?
No.
You should be.
Salt water and water and... Yeah. We tried to get more other liquids with our pizza, but the guy forgot to actually bring them.
Oh, that sucks. I've had that happen before. It's not fun.
No.
Is it the flu or just a cold?
I don't know.
Do you have a fever?
It's mostly just my throat, so hopefully it's not strep or something.
That's going around.
Yeah, everyone's been sick.
Yeah, I hope you don't have it either.
I somehow managed to completely avoid Concred. I don't know how.
Wow, that's impressive.
I was okay until Fred got sick.
Yeah, blame it on him.
He shared.
So how's everybody doing?
Good.
Yeah, pretty decent. I've got a guest in the house, so I am up here with At Felt It. Sitting on the bed, and she's watching her laptop on the headphones, and I'm sitting here on the podcast. So it's like modern living, ladies and gentlemen.
Modern living. You get to ignore your spouse.
No, I'm not. I can never ignore my spouse.
Oh, okay.
Ever.
Just making sure, yeah. Well, how's everyone's gaming life this week? Anything new?
I'm stressed.
Why is that?
I'm running a game tomorrow, and I have a lot of open parts of the story. It's not very well defined, and that makes me very nervous.
Ah.
Do you need help filling holes, or it's just a matter of you haven't had time to do it?
No, I've had time. But I've been running a ton of games or playing in a ton of games in the past like 2 weeks. So not a lot. But I can't talk about it because my wife is right behind me.
Oh.
She says hello.
Say hello.
But I mean, more generally, it's like, you know, I normally tend to have a good idea where things are going to go. And I leave, like, big decisions will be Dragon Age-y, where, sure, there's really big decisions that matter, but not necessarily with where you're going to go or what the dungeon is going to look like or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but this one, right from the get-go, they have some major choices that will change at least the first encounter. Which means I didn't really write a first encounter, and everything could go horribly wrong.
Right.
I believe in you.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to do the less planning, more on the spot sort of stuff, and we'll see.
Could be fun to see where your players take it.
Yeah, it could be. That's what I'm hoping. But I could also be staring at like five people that are just staring at me.
Oh yeah, that does. Going, suck.
Where's can you lead us to encounter one, please?
I've been there. Yeah.
When I did the game at PAX East for the new players, the Learn to Play, the second group, I had it all set up. They're gonna go in the dungeon. You know, it's gonna be fine. And they're being hired to help with some caravan raiders, and they're like, "Well, we want to dress up like merchants and have the caravan go out there and like." Have them ambush us. It's like, oh, crap. Okay.
Yeah. Whip it out. Right. Like, no, it doesn't say that in the book.
Yeah.
So fortunately, the other side of the map had the ability, you know, had
the had a road on it, right? Yeah.
I was like, okay, there you are. I took a piece of, I took one of my index cards and I cut out a wagon shape on it. And I was like, you're on the wagon. What are you doing? Tell me what you're doing.
Not that you had it handy, but the Dark Sun or the Dark Sun dungeon tile set has a little 3D wagon.
It does.
I've used that for a lot of different things. It's a nice thing to have handy.
Well, that's what they kind of what they did to us was that they had hoped to have a learn to play adventure for 2 hours,
right.
And they didn't have that done, so they just gave us a bunch of red boxes and were like, "Here, make something out of this for 2 hours."
See, nice. Now, Mike, that brings up a good point with that, because I would totally buy for like $2.99 or even $3.99 a single tile piece like that. That's like a wagon, something so extraordinarily useful that you'll have it on your table all the time. And it's like, you always need a wagon, you always need horses, you always need certain things, and those would be so cool to have. Just buy them in a little pack, you know? It's just like one little thing, but...
I mean, if you pay $4.99 or $3.99 for a wagon, you might as well just spend the $8 on the whole set.
Well, maybe, but I'm just, you know, revenue streams. But no, that's a useful piece. It is.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it. I've got it sitting right over there.
Those are the fruit carts, though. Wait, is there one that's a full wagon?
Yeah, I think there's one that's a wagon. Yeah, there's a little wagon. It's a little posh. It's got like a padded seat and stuff. But
oh, that would have worked great because I told them that they negotiated to get the really nice wagon, but the guy was like, "You better bring this back to me in good shape, or else run out of your pay."
It's cute when the NPCs make idle threats.
Yeah.
Did you guys already talk about what kind of superhero Tracy was at PAX?
No.
She was a superhero at PAX. Like, I swear, every time I was wandering around and kind of playing in games and waiting in line and, you know, having fun and doing everything, and every time I looked over and saw Tracy, she was working. Like, she was running a game, or she was running between games, or she was getting ready for her next game. She was, you know, nonstop.
Well, are you surprised at this? Because we already knew that that's how she is.
I hadn't seen it at a con before.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
I think we're going to try to prevent that at Gen Con.
Yeah, she inspired me. I ran a couple of Dungeon Delve games right at the end, because I said, you know, I should give back a little, and I also don't feel like waiting in line. And if I don't have to wait in line, I can just run it.
Well, and the people at Play are often so nice, particularly at like something like PAX or New York Comic Con. I mean, they're nice at Gen Con and stuff too, but then you have the players that are much more entrenched and like they know how they want to play. And with a lot of the people at like PAX East, they just anything is good is great. Like, it's just a different experience,
right? So how did your you and I never really talked about how your DM challenge game went. How did it go?
It went okay.
What was it like? Tell us about your adventure and tell us what happened at the game.
So my adventure is at Surprise Tries around a caravan. But it was basically they were going to this coronation. There was this ancient crown that was found, and whoever had it could become king if they went through a coronation ceremony at an ancient rune site. And of course, they get attacked by a manticore, a succubus, and some kobold hordes.
Of course.
Of course.
As it happens. Yeah.
As it happens. Yeah. And then from there, you know, they could trace the steps back to this huge cave complex for a red dragon, and the easiest way for them to sneak in was through the dragon's pet basilisk's lair. So that's how they did that. And then the end was the really cool thing I used were the kobold, I think they're called worm guards. They have this ability to basically mark either another creature or an item, and whichever PC is closest to that creature will take extra damage so long as the target keeps taking damage. So they mark the dragon, the guy next to the dragon will get a ton of damage on top of whatever the dragon will do to him.
Wow.
So they really love that.
Yeah, I bet. How were your players?
They're pretty good. I mean, they were much closer to the established type. So it was harder to get them into, you know, talking about the story or like, let's just describe what your character would do. It was much more mechanical. Although there was one guy at the table that this was the second ever D&D game. And he was just, after a while, he was just like, "Can I just be crazy?" And I was like, "Yeah, go ahead. Tell me what you want to do because we'll do anything." And he played the thief. So the thief's a good one to go crazy with. So he was riding the basilisk and
awesome,
and everything like that. And they're like, that's really cool. And they also used, like, I put a pool in of boiling hot water, and they liked boiling the kobold alive in it.
Oh.
That was
wow.
That was another. They would see it right away, and they're like, I want to put the kobold in the water.
Thank God for slides.
Because I had to run it twice. A few of the DMs who had signed up didn't show up for the game, but they had people lining up at 4:30 to play the game that was supposed to start at 7.
Wow.
So the next day, a couple of the groups, they didn't have enough DMs for it. They said, hey, come back tomorrow, and we'll have someone run an adventure for you. And I agreed to do it the next day,
That's cool.
I ran it twice. The second group I liked a little bit more. They were just totally making like crazy stuff up, you know. But I think they were much more. They were a gaming group already, so it was a lot easier in that aspect. There was that trust.
They'd already been together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was yours?
Not bad. I was happy to do it. I enjoyed it. The game ran well. They all seemed to have a really good time. I suck at pre-gen characters. I mean, so my little secret trick was that I didn't actually make the pre-gens. My group did. And they used them for my playtest. And the problem is I overthought the how they should be built. So I was very careful to make sure that there were like 4 essentials builds and 2 non-essentials builds in case I got some anti-essentialites.
Yeah.
At my table, I could say like, okay, does anybody here hate essentials? And I say, yeah. And I go, okay, well, these are the 2 you're going to want to pick. And I also made them in sets of difficulty, like 2 really easy to play, 2 that were medium and 2 that were hard. And one of the hard ones was so hard I couldn't figure it out. So that was bad when it turned out.
Player Handbook 3.
No, it was the wizard. It was the mage from Essentials. And I don't get how they work. And it was the only time I've ever seen a character that a power that has 2 power cards. And that just blows my mind. So he's like, I don't understand. It has 2 cards that do different things. And I'm like, I don't understand either. So that was bad. And I don't know how memorization works. Memorization was weird. So it was made by one of my tweakier players, and he didn't really explain it to me. So I wasn't really able to explain it to them. So that sucked. I had almost everybody there was pretty new to 4E. I think the most experienced person had played a couple times the day before.
Right.
And trying to teach 4E at 8th
level. Yeah.
4 hours for an entire game.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but they cut me off. They cut me off earlier than I expected. Like, they had to put in their surveys at 11, and I thought we had till midnight. And we were done like 12:10. So
we went to midnight as well.
I think almost everybody did. I guess Dave was one of the few that made it all the way through and ended on time. And he just, when he heard dragon, apparently he just poured dragons in his. Like, all the players were dragons, Every battle was against dragons. He he and I went on the train together there, and he lugged his colossal red all the way up from Washington to Boston in a bag. And if you've seen that red dragon, it's like the most, transportable, unfriendly object you could possibly try to carry on a train. I mean, it's all spikes and big.
Yeah.
And
So I do have to thank you, though, for the unicorn idea.
Oh, did you put the unicorn in?
Yeah, the unicorn was on the altar. So basically the crown had this stone in it that was purported to be have the soul of an ancient red dragon. So, of course, my red dragon thought that was his grandfather or something. and there's a unicorn on the altar being sacrificed to, like, help bring this, break the spell.
Was the unicorn
crystal
sacrificed?
No, they, of course, needed to save the unicorn. But they were being very funny about it. The second group in particular is being very funny about it. So, like, you have to save this unicorn. It's a unicorn. But when it wakes up, it's going to be angry and grumpy and probably going to go after us. So why don't we restrain it? I got to use some hippie tricks with them, too.
Oh, there you go with the hippies again.
Yeah, the hippies again. So they're basically, they wanted to seal, the second group snuck past the basilisk while they're sleeping, and they wanted to seal the basilisk in. But they're like, we don't have any nails the ceiling or whatever. And I was like, well, you did fight a manticore. Did anybody, you know, raid the body, loot the body of the manticore for anything? And they're like, oh yeah, we have these armed spikes now. We're hitting them in. Mm-hmm. You know, just totally letting them do that.
Awesome.
And they used the spell to silence room, which like nobody uses, but it was awesome that they did.
They used a ritual for that?
I think it's a spell.
Was it a power?
In Essentials, yeah. The one nice thing about the Essentials Mage is that it has some spells that it can use outside of combat that are more role-playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Because all my characters were Essentials. Because they're easy to build.
Really? I thought you hated Essentials.
Oh, I didn't like playing Essentials, but, you know... It's
not good enough for you, but it's good enough for your players.
Oh, actually,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I'm not seeing a contradiction here. So you know,
it was either that or auto build on the character builder. So,
that would be really entertaining.
Oh, geez, yeah, that's
never good.
I think that would be hilarious to run one like that, though. That'd be great.
Yeah, I just ran out of time because they really only gave us about 2 or 3 weeks to do it all.
Yeah, it wasn't a lot. I spent like 20 hours on my adventure, and the main reason is because I wanted to put up on my website. And by the way, my shameless plug, it is available on my website at slyflourish.com. slyflourish.com/gravemist if you want to find it.
All right, very good.
Spell grave list.
GRAVEMYST.
All right.
And it's available in a PDF. So I wanted to make it nice and publishy. And that took forever. And playtesting, it really helped. I learned a lot in the playtest. Yeah, it was a good time.
Mike, did you use a particular template or something when you did that?
No, I made that up. I use Apple Pages. And I have a little adventure template that I use to make it.
Oh, okay.
The hard part were the stat blocks. Those stat blocks are actual tables and pages. And the first one took me like 2 or 3 hours to make.
Oh, wow.
But once I got it, that meant I could just cut and paste it and refill it.
Cool.
So, yeah. It was really fun. I was really glad I did it. I don't know how this is going to sound. I was happy that Tracy and Dave didn't win either because it meant I was in really good company. I had this like fear because I knew one other guy. I knew the James Gimmel is the third. He was the third place winner. And he's a guy that I met at Gen Con about 3 years ago. And he was I think he was the runner up in the DM Iron Dungeon Master competition that they had there about 3 years ago. And he was the winner from the years previous. So he's a very good DM.
Wow.
And yeah, he's a really neat guy. And he got third place. So that was cool. But he was the only person that I knew personally who even got within the top three.
Now, how do they, what kind of form do they fill out like to determine who wins?
We weren't allowed to see them.
Okay.
At all. Either, you know, maybe unfilled we could have seen them, but certainly not filled in. And I think they had like 7 criteria. Tracy, maybe you remember what the criteria was, but it was like character, story, content, preparation.
Challenge and, it was presentation, challenge, and fun.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, my group, there were certainly areas that I knew I needed to work on. And the guy who won, and I'm trying to get an interview with him for Critical Hits, the guy who won got a perfect score. Apparently they all ranked him at the top.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah. And you don't know who you're going to be playing with. So it wasn't like he loaded him up with his friends or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing also that worked well for me was, so I had that elf scout at the beginning who comes running out with the iron spikes in his back from the manicure. I put a four-sided die down, and every round I decreased the number. So it kind of like built that tension. They wanted to save the scout too.
Right.
And every time they saw that, you know, go from 4 to 3, like, oh my God, gotta get over there.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a battle. My first battle in my thing was saving a bunch of villagers from a bunch of rabid vampires. And
the big thing vampires?
No, they weren't sparkly. They were very mean. They were covered in blood. I got to describe.
See, that's why you horrible. Didn't win, because you weren't playing to the demographic there, Mike.
No, they were all pretty hardcore. I don't think there were any sparkly vampire types in that group. But it was cool because they were watching the civilians die, and they knew, like, we got to stop these guys before all the civilians are dead. So it had a nice, you know, it wasn't like, oh, well, we can just fight these guys that are fighting us. It was like, we actually need to ignore the guys that are fighting us and go after the guys that aren't. That was a fun little twist, and it worked out pretty well.
Nice.
Cool.
Well, I have to say, in my last D&D game, guys, I finally, Mike, I know what you're talking about now with solos and how the older ones are broken.
Oh, yeah.
They came up on the, I don't know if you remember or have played in, crap. It's the one right after Shadowfell Keep. We keep on the Shadowfell.
Thunderspire.
Yeah, Thunderspire Labyrinth. The name had gone blank for a minute.
Yeah, it's but, a great adventure.
Great adventure, but the solo in the test, you know, the dragon that comes out.
Okay, yeah, so right.
don't talk about too
spoiler
much.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, wait. Yeah, sorry.
Not to talk about it too much. I've been in a play-by-post game, and we've been in Thunderspire Labyrinth for 2 years now, so... I wish I was exaggerating, but I'm not.
So was it a green dragon?
Play-by-post goes slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
And totally broken. They walked all over it.
Yeah.
And the circulating trap, and I'm trying not to give away too many spoilers here, basically a big cotton ball. I mean,
it just didn't do enough damage?
Yeah, it just wasn't. I mean, for all the gloom and doom that surrounded it, it was nothing. Yeah. I mean, it would roll over them and the characters would go, it tickled.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was like, oh, well, that's kind of disappointing. But it did give me a good sense of what, I mean, I know you've been talking about that for a long, long time. And it's like, and I'm going, yeah, well, okay, maybe. Or maybe Mike just really likes powerful, you know, monsters.
Yeah, no.
but they really are. Working out the math, it was just like, oh, well, yeah, this is kind of weak. It's not giving them a challenge at all. So, yeah, that'll change.
Yeah, the new damage chart, you know, in the new Dungeon Master screen and in the DM kit book, that's worth its weight in gold. You know, keeping that handy and just going through any adventure that you're going to run that's older than the Monster Manual 3 and scratching out the damage numbers and replacing it with new ones.
Yeah, that's certainly going to be good advice. Absolutely. So, but lesson learned, and it was good to actually see it in play. It's one thing to hear people talk about it, but to actually see it in play and go, "Wow, yeah, you're right."
Yeah, but what's funny is I played that 2 years ago, and 2 years ago it was a challenge. I mean, they fought it, but the dragon was spoiler. You know, they were continually getting hit, and the dragon's nasty effect was affecting them a lot. So it was it wasn't the most challenging fight in that area, but it was. It caught their attention, and that was. But they were playing all PHP 1, and there wasn't any other books.
Oh yeah, that makes a difference, because I had a one of my players was just locking it. It was a what is those guys?
Sword mage?
No, it was the tall giant guys, or the giant guys that are living in the mountains. Yeah, it was Goliath. Yeah, and a Goliath warrior, and he was just locking it down. I mean, it couldn't move, and so it was just. Anything that made it effective, like its flyby attack and stuff like that, totally just locked it down. So, but anyway, that was, you know, I mean, it wasn't a disappointing fight. I mean, I enjoyed it, and I think the players did too. It was just that, and they were happy that they got to kill a dragon. but it would have been nice to see it put a little bit more scare into them than what it did.
Yeah, I think in ours, and Aaron, you may want to block your ears for a moment. In ours, that dragon had a gaze attack that could push. Okay, I think it could slide people, and he was continually sliding people into the pit.
Oh yeah, see, they brought it out into the hallway.
Oh yeah.
And after that, it was just like
didn't matter where you slide him to.
Yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, yeah, it was just a good example of some of the stuff that it's helpful to see it actually in play. Theory is great, but until you actually mm-hmm. roll the dice around the table, it can make a difference sometimes. So
yeah, it can be hard to picture why the old solos aren't really working until you see it firsthand. I mean, I fought the in one of the games I was a player in, we fought the old Orcus, the original one, and it was just
it was
a snooze fest. I mean, he couldn't do enough damage to do. I mean, he almost killed the assassin in our party, but that assassin was a glass cannon anyway, so it didn't really feel like he was any threat to most of the party. And it was just a matter of grinding him down. Eventually, who else did we fought? What was the big guy out of Monster Manual 2?
Demogorgon.
Yes, thank you. We fought him as well, and again, he just didn't feel like a credible threat. So I haven't been able to play with some of the Monster Manual 3 solos, but I do see why the old ones didn't work.
Yeah.
They're better, but they're still not perfect. I mean, some of them played as is. What level were the guys that were fighting Orcus and Demogorgon? Were they 30?
Yeah, we were 30.
Yeah, so, I mean, a group of level 30 will kill just about anything. It won't matter, you know, what you do to them. And you really, what I found, you know, I cheated in my, I think I've already talked about this, but I cheated in my my big level 30 Orcus fight by having them fight him twice and not realize that they were going to have to fight him again. So I got one free shot where they fought Orcus. They fought a revision of Orcus that I had done, and I saw what they did to him. And then I built the next Orcus knowing what they were going to do. And it made a bigger difference. But it was all like environmental effects and, you know, in-battle skill challenges. And they felt a little gypped because they were like, you know, he wasn't tough on his own. He was tough because he had these other little crazy things. Like, well, yeah, it's the only way he was going to survive. So... I don't think there's much you can do against level 30s other than just throw two encounters worth of stuff on them at once and, you know, give ongoing 30 damage to the whole environment.
I mean, were there other monsters along with her, or was it just environmental effects that you used?
For Orcus, it was just him.
Yeah.
You know, I built a version of him called Orcus, the God of Death, and he was a 35 instead of a 33. And probably the biggest difference was that he had a damage shield that was like the old... second edition and third edition fire shield, where anytime he took damage, whoever did the damage to him took 30 fire and unresistible 30 fire.
Wow.
So it meant that when they would go up to him and hit him six times in a row, you know, they'd be taking whatever, 100 and who's good at math? What's six?
180.
Times? 180 points of damage.
Well, that's like, I mean, the players have those abilities too. It's like, what is that, Rain of Steel or whatever, where they, the stance that they activate that anytime they get hit, the whoever hit them takes, you know.
Oh, God.
This is a low level, you know. Yeah, it's,
yeah,
it's,
I hate,
you know,
that one. I hate that.
Yeah, it's a minion chewer. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to deal with.
Yeah. So I've just, you know, I find more and more anytime you've got a boss, you have to have some kind of environmental effect or some kind of protection that you have to give them in order to make sure they don't get just aced.
Yeah, I've been putting them along with other monsters. I mean, maybe making the solo a little lower level and then just making it more like a regular encounter in that respect, adding some minions and some other standard monsters just to make it so they can't concentrate entirely on the boss, lest they get their ass kicked from something else.
Right. Yeah, the only problem is then your game gets longer.
Well, yeah. But I don't necessarily see the problem with that as long as you're having fun with it.
Sure, yeah.
Well, I think that one of the things that, especially as you get higher level, you almost need to put in story elements and alternate outcomes for certain encounters. In other words, yeah, fine, you could kill Orcus, but if the guy that they got chained to the wall is the savior of the whole world and they kill him, you lose.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, that's and those things might seem contrived, but if they're part of the story or whatever, then it makes it even more epic. And so maybe we save the guy, or the demon lives for another day, or maybe he's cast away for 100 years, but he's going to be back. But yet you at least saved the savior of the world or whatever, you know. So there's, yeah, like I said, I think a story element is very important there when you're talking about epic level campaigns. But you would know all about that, Mike, because you wrote a book about it.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
No. But good stuff.
I tell you, it's a lot of fun getting back to heroic tier. You know, I'm running a heroic tier Dark Sun game now, and it's a lot nicer in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I just got? I just won the Kingmaker Adventure Path from Paizo. And I'm thinking of converting it to 4E because it looks really, really cool.
Hmm.
That noise in the background, was it in response to your comment, Sam?
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. I start talking and Randall starts vomiting. I know how it is.
No, Anna's watching Top Chef over here next to me. And, and someone said something. She's got her headphones on, so I can't hear the show, obviously. And she suddenly went, oh, something happened. But anyway, sorry about that.
But anyway, I don't actually have any experience with Pathfinder. Yeah, except for their game mastery guide is really good, and I won this whole adventure path. It's a six 120 page or 600 page adventure books, and it goes from levels one through let me see, 1 through 15. But the last one, you start at 15 and you end at 20. So basically, it's supposed to take you. For Pathfinder, that's the whole path, right? Whereas 4E goes to 30th level. So, but I'm curious how it's going to go. I don't have a lot to say about it right now, but as I read the first book, I think, oh, to go back to heroic tier, because right now my face to face group is in mid Paragon. So, yeah.
So, Monster Maker.
The Monster Renamer, you mean?
The Monster Renamer.
I think you can actually change their level now, but you can't change anything else, right?
Can you not change any of their stats?
I don't think so.
I don't know, but that's what I understand.
No, you can't. I was in it earlier today, and you can adjust the level, which adjusts all the baths on the monster.
Right.
But there's no, you can rename powers, but you cannot change or swap out powers. You can't do basically anything to it. It's really kind of disappointing. And I don't like to say that because I really like a lot of most of what Wizard of the Coast does. And it's a disappointment. I think they could have done better for an initial rollout. Now, I can only hope that there's additional features to be added later on. But at this point,
I think part of the problem is that, you know, 2 months ago when they started the beta test, that was basically all you could do. So really, in 2 months, have they added? Now you can change the level, and that's pretty much it.
Well, I mean, what have they managed to accomplish in the time that they've stopped supporting the downloadable monster builder? I mean, they really...
It's got all the Monster Vault guys in it.
Yeah, I mean, and I honestly, I don't think that's all that terribly great an accomplishment. So
but I mean, they have been working on the virtual table stuff too, though. I mean, it's not a huge team that's working on this. I think.
No, I understand that. It's just.
Well, my thing. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Aaron.
It's just that it's disappointing that it's been this long, and it doesn't. They haven't even got up to where they left off with the downloadable one. That's my problem with it, is that I kind of felt like they should have held off making it the web builder until they'd at least gotten it up to the same standard that they'd gotten with the downloadable.
What advantage is there in not putting it out now? Like, what's the advantage for us if they had not put it out now?
They could have kept supporting what they already had.
For me, it's not if they have an advantage not putting it out, because basically, you know, if all I can do is change the level of a monster, I'm not going to use it, right? So for me, because I work on a PC now, I know lots of Mac people might find it really helpful because it's in the cloud, right? But you know, I guess my thing is I know it's a small team, that the small development team that's working on the character builder and the monster builder and virtual table and all the digital initiatives and all that stuff. And that's fine. I mean, I know it's a tiny team, but that doesn't mean that you should release something before it's really useful.
I would argue that, I mean, so I think it is useful. I think most people aren't really doing a lot of changes to the monsters.
Okay, but then you've got the compendium. You can just pull the monster up and print out.
But you can't change the level. with the math already done.
Yeah, true.
I guess my question. Oh, sorry.
The only other thing I was going to say is that if they had kept supporting the downloadable one, I mean, there are business problems with continuing to do that, and on top of it, those are resources that would have been taken away from doing the online digital initiative, and you wouldn't have had them as easily worked in with the virtual table.
I'm not advocating that they keep working on the downloadable one. I know that one is dead for them, but my problem is, why release something?
I really want it.
I see the benefit in Mac users getting to use it and being able to change levels, but I just, for me, it's not very useful. So I'm sort of like, okay, well, you know, they're just like when they released the character builder and you couldn't export your character. Well, that was sort of not useful to me. So, you know, it's sort of, I sort of feel the same way about this, that they're doing things. Yeah, they're making a little bit of progress, but it's sort of not useful for me right now. So I'm not all that excited about it.
And it doesn't feel like a product that's complete. I mean, that's
it isn't. It says beta.
Well, I know, but even when they take the beta tag off, is it still going to have all the things that the downloadable had? Is it going to be able to do everything that a monster builder should be able to do? And that's
according to everyone, probably not.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand why they did what they did. I see their reasoning entirely. It's just that it feels a bit disappointing that we've kind of gone a long time between having the workable downloadable and having a fully functional web-based. And that gap seems kind of – it's part of why I canceled my DDI subscription. It doesn't feel like they've really done enough for me to justify hanging on to it.
I can understand that. I'm not trying to say that you guys should feel a different way. Honestly, for me, the downloadable one had gotten to the point where it was unusable for me. The fact that it had so many bugs in it made it way more frustrating. I'd rather just handwrite extra powers than try to deal with the fact that it would reset immediate. I think sometimes the immediate interrupt would get changed in immediate reaction all the time whenever I tried to export it out or print it into an image. So, I mean, I understand. I don't know.
The funny thing to me is, I mean, I kind of don't care. I've been using the compendium, and I'll probably keep using the compendium, and it's fine. You know, and I made the mistake, and I always make this mistake, of reading the forums where somebody referred to it as a hate crime.
Oh God! Oh,
what? Come
yeah,
on!
I'm serious. It's an honest to God quote. And the
stay
problem
off
is
the forums, Mike.
I know. I shouldn't have gone to the forums. And my point is, like, people feel, and maybe it's because they had these big expectations for what they were going to see, and then they were disappointed, and that's fine. But a lot of people are like, you know, well, this is an insult, and it's, you know, they shouldn't have put it out yet. And so the argument I hear is, we've been waiting a long time for something to come out, and now it's out, and we don't like it, so it shouldn't have come out yet. So we should have waited longer. And my point is, like, I'd rather have something than nothing, you know, like, it doesn't do everything I want it to do, but I can grab screenshots and I can stick, you know, monster stat blocks in a Word document and print it. So it kind of does what I need, but so does the compendium. So,
right. So what you're saying is, your statement was you'd rather have something than nothing. But for me, because it doesn't give me the usability that I need, then it is the same as getting nothing.
So then you should be as happy as you were 5 hours ago.
I am. I'm not. Trust me. I am not. I'm not one to go on the forums and be complaining. I just, you know, that's why I said I'm just not. I'm not all hyped up about it like a lot of people are, because I know that it's going to take time for it to get. You know, it's like the character builder. I'm perfectly happy with the character builder now. Was I happy with it before? No. When they first released it, it was, you know, it wasn't ready for prime time as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No,
They've done the same thing with the monster builder. So I know that in a couple months it'll probably be up to speed and I'll be happy. But I'm not. You know, I'm also not out there railing on the forums and on Twitter and talking about how horrible it is. You know, I don't really care right now.
I mean, the character builder, I think, is a lot more justified because we almost need the character builder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you can't make I don't really think you can make characters easy. I mean, no organized plaything will let you walk up with a hand-done character. you know, right. You have to have one from the builder. So the builder has to work, or you really can't. I mean, I'm being, you know, there are lots of people saying, yeah, you can still play if you handwrite your thing on a piece of paper, but nobody does. Everybody needs the math done for them because the math is really hard. Right. And so you need the character builder, but as a DM, you don't need a monster builder. You know, I'm very happy right now with the fact that I can play right out of the monster vault. I'm playing tomorrow night and I've got the Dark Sun creature catalog and the monster vault, and I'm not printing anything. And that's awesome that I can do that now because the monsters are fixed. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm not too bent out of shape about it.
And the other thing, particularly with it being a beta, is that you want to get something like this out there and start getting feedback from your customers. I mean, the thing is yeah, it doesn't do a lot of the event stuff that the downloadable one did, but I'm not sure how many of the average users of the downloadable monster builder really used all those features. I think, you know, and there is a lot of business value for them, and like even development value in just seeing what customers say, what they really need, and start working on them, and hopefully working on them in a way that has fewer bugs than the downloadable one had.
Right, right. Well, I see. So from the development perspective, I totally see the value in doing the beta test. My whole point was, well, you know, I know it's a beta and it doesn't do what I want, so it's not really worth it for me to go, you know, I mean, like, I just, you know, I'm not that concerned about it, but Randall had something.
Yeah, I think one of the most, or one of the vocalist, or one of the loudliest, no, that's not even a word. one of the most vocal groups, I think, is the creative community here, because quite frankly, one of the reasons I liked the original Monster Builder was because I could fill in gaps that didn't exist. For example, I couldn't have written my entire article on Modrons had I not had a fully flexible Monster Builder that I could print out really nice looking stat blocks with powers built in and everything designed just so. And I think there are a lot of other places, you know, you can't whip together an original module with or an adventure and want to sell it unless you're creating your own stuff. Unless you, there are a bunch of rules or whatever, you know, you can't steal other people's IP, obviously. So it helps to be able to build that and have that to build. And I think that's probably one aspect where it's going to hurt, because I won't build monster stat blocks by hand. It's a pain in the ass. I'm not going to do it. And so I will create my adventures using existing monsters. I could do that for my own use. I don't have a problem with that. But if I want to create anything original, it's going to be really challenging because I won't have a very nice tool that helps me do that. So, I mean, that's my opinion, of obviously, and that's for me. But I think that's going to be one large vocal group, or a small, very loud group, that will say, I don't like the new one because it doesn't let me be as creative as I want to be. So.
I just have a quick question. The downloadable one still works though, right? It just doesn't have the new content. Right.
It does. And that is correct. And I can adjust the maths on those so that it matches any of the new monsters that comes up. Absolutely true. And I don't want to, you know, and it, like I said, if there's enhanced connectivity between the virtual table and the new monster builder, I'm all for that, because, but I haven't tested that out as a DM on the virtual table. So I don't know if that's hooked up yet. So I would assume that was part of the advancements they had made so far. Obviously there is no export yet. But like Sam said, with the character builder, there wasn't in the beginning either. And I expect that to see that as a feature pretty soon. But anyway, at this point, I'm in a waiting pattern on it. I mean, I still like my DDI subscription. I do find stuff in it as a DM, so I'm not, you know, I'm not jumping up and down about it, and I'm not pissed off or nothing. It would be nice to have it as full featured as before.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, let me clarify. I'm not pissed off about things. That's not why I dropped my DDI subscription. I just felt that I wasn't getting what I wanted out of it. I mean, there's.
Well, sure.
As soon as DDI comes, as soon as I feel like DDI is worth it again, I'll be more than happy to subscribe again.
Sure.
I mean, I know Aaron's really, really pissed about it, but no. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that how much this is a really good, you know, anybody out there who does anything with marketing, this is a really good marketing example, where if they had said it differently when they did the release and said, we are extending the closed beta to everybody with DDI and we'd like you to try it out, and it's not full featured and we know there are things missing, but we want you to take a look at it as we add these things, instead of saying we are releasing the Monster Builder, would have completely changed all of the, I think. I mean, they'd still have a bunch of jerks, but generally people might say, oh, well, I looked at it and it's missing these features and I'll try it again when those features are added. But instead they made it sound like it was fully released and it's done. And everyone's saying, no, it's not. So,
but see, WotC has this problem. I mean, I try not to bag on WotC a lot because, you know, they're just a company, and I like to interact with a lot of the people that work there. And I know that, you know, you can ask a single individual at that company, you know, if their goal is to destroy D&D or whatever, and nobody is going to say yes, right? I mean, that's just not what it's about. So I try not to bag on WotC too much, because I know that a lot of the major decisions are made with a lot of things in mind that I just don't know, you know, because I'm not part of the company. But, you know, they tend to do this where they, you know, it all comes down to somebody saying, well, you know, if they had done the marketing a little better, it's like, well, you know, hire some damn professional marketers that know what they're doing then, that know not just what they're doing, but know the role-playing community. Because oftentimes that's what it comes down to as well. If they had just, you know, put it at this way instead of trying to spin it to make it sound like the best new thing, then people wouldn't be so upset. So having said that, I'm not actually sure if that's the case. I think that there are plenty of elements in the role-playing community that people will just – they just want something to complain about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're always going to have, you know, haters and stuff, so. But,
yeah, so anyway.
So, hey, if I yes. may be allowed to change the topic.
Absolutely.
I made a comment yesterday about multiclassing.
Mm-hmm.
Should we talk about multiclassing?
I don't like it.
What was the comment, and what kind of response did it get?
Let me see if I can go find it. Well, here, hold on a second.
I'm pretty sure I could paraphrase it there for you, Randall.
Well, no. I think I have it on. Okay, here it is. On Twitter, I said, psst, multiclassing is for pussies or elves, but mostly pussies. And then I hashtagged it with pick a class, goddammit. There's only 40 some to choose from. So, and yeah, you might have I'm to bleep you. Some of that out, but that's okay. But it was tongue-in-cheek. I'm not deadly serious about it. It's tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, I don't care how you play the game. It was sort of from an argument – or not an argument, but a discussion I was witnessing on Twitter about, you know, various ways that you can do multiclassing and how currently 4E handles that and stuff. And I'm perfectly fine with it, because I think that otherwise – and this is – again, this is Dead Orcs talking. This is my old man opinion, and this is a little bit of the grognard in me that says, have a developed and coherent story for your character. You cannot be everything, okay? And the folks that really want to be the fighter thief, I mean the fighter rogue magic user cleric, either don't know what they want, or have the wrong idea about what a good hero in a story is. And so, again, that's going to sound like a strong opinion, and people are going to immediately be listening to this and going, oh my God, I can't believe you said that, you know? What about what I want? And that's fine, and I'm okay with that. It wouldn't happen in my campaigns. So...
I think...
Go ahead. No, fight me. I'm ready for it.
Fight you. No. So, I actually had a really... good story reason why, well, I thought it was a good story reason why I had to multi-class, but you know, whatever, you can decide that you don't like multi-classing if you want, and you have limited stories, that's okay.
Well, let me clarify though, because you had a regular 4E legal multi-classed character, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's okay. I like the way 4E does it just fine, the way it's done. But there were folks arguing that it needs to be like it was in the old days,
oh,
or
God,
whatever.
So broken.
I know, and that's part of it. And it's like, wow, guys, 4E handles it just fine. There are actually rules for multiclassing. What are you complaining about? And I guess that's really what was my whole point with the tongue in cheek. So no, Tracy, I and I'm sure you did, and I would allow it in my campaign if I thought there was a great story reason behind it. And
listen.
Yeah.
Sarah needed something to go up against Jim's Dark Magic's magic missile. That's all I have to say.
Hey, fair enough. You know what? that stands on its own. Yeah, absolutely. So, but anyway. So I was just interested in what everyone else feels about. You know, are the rules adequate? Are they not? I think they are.
Well, I've heard lots of people. So this was in the early 4E days. Now, anyway, this was not recently, but I've heard people complain about the multi-classing that, that it sucked and that it wasn't good enough or whatever. I don't really know. And the reason that was the case was, at least coming from these two particular people that complained to me about it, was that it didn't really let you multi-class. What it does is you pick a class and then you can sort of get a taste of another class, and you can sort of learn a little bit of another class, and sort of that was your way of multi-classing. And I think that's fine. I think that's sort of how it would be in real life, right? There is no one who can do everything perfectly and with 100% skill. Right. And lots of people are really good at one thing or two things, and then are okay at some other things and not so great at some other things. And that's why we're not all, you know, living on our own single islands somewhere, surviving just fine. And I think the reason they didn't like it was because it just didn't let them be really powerful in two classes equally. It made them pick one major one and taste a little bit of the other one and, you know, and let it be that way. So right. I don't know what spurred your comment. I have a feeling I'm missing a little bit of the context, because I don't know why you would just come out and make that comment out of the blue. But
well, like I said, it was a Twitter conversation that I had witnessed, and
oh, okay, so it was in response to an actual conversation that happened before.
Yeah, I was lurking the conversation. It wasn't anything I was actively participating in. Mm-hmm. But and I saw that in the morning, and I went to lunch, and I was cogitating about it, and then I came back, and I thought, oh, I'll be a smart ass on Twitter today, and so I posted that. So, you know, but I just, but I thought it would bring up a good point for discussion, because people do have issues about it. So.
Yeah, I mean.
So, sorry, Mike, but what were the issues? I mean, your comment's pretty strong, but I mean, what was there an actual conversation, or was it just people getting riled up for? I mean,
I was participating in the conversation, so maybe I can lay some context. Okay. Basically, Jerry Dread Gazebo, he was saying that he wasn't a fan of how 4th edition multiclassing works, and a few other people chimed in about how they preferred the old versions, and there was some back and forth about the merits and flaws of multiclassing in different versions of D&D. Mm. And it was a civil conversation. Nobody said you're wrong or you're an idiot or anything like that. So yeah, it certainly wasn't an argument. It was definitely just a regular discussion. But that's pretty much how it came out, that there were some issues with multiclassing and hybrids, especially hybrids. People seem to have really strong feelings in the negative towards that, and that's what led up to Randall.
Yeah, I think so.
So Mike, before I let you talk, can I ask a question?
No.
Well, sorry, I'm gonna do it.
You were asking me.
Yeah, I know. So I never really played 3.0 or 3.5 all that much. I played a ton of 1E and 2E, and I know about multiclassing in those two systems and in 4E, but is third edition multiclassing really super broken? Is that what they wanted? Is that what they were comparing it to, or is it something else?
Are you speaking to all of us or just Mike?
I'm wondering about the conversation. I mean, I guess I'm speaking to everyone, because I never played third edition, so, or at least I played it a couple times, but not enough to really remember or know the differences. Is multiclassing in third edition really broken, and that's sort of what maybe people are lamenting to make fourth edition go back to, or?
In this particular case, I don't think they were lamenting going back to a broken system. Just because of the people involved, I'm pretty sure that that's not the case. I'm sure some of the people who hate 4th edition multiclassing do want to go back to that. And I personally feel that the 3.0 and 3X multiclassing, you could really break it easily. You could you could break it in one of the two directions. You could break it and make a ridiculously powerful character, or you could break it in terms of you've just made a character who, you know, shouldn't be allowed outside without a guide. That kind of useless kind of character.
Yeah.
So
everyone had tips about how to build a character. I thought there was something like you wouldn't want to take more than a few levels in fighter and then you'd want to move on to something else. At least that's what one of the guys told me. But I know there were lots of tricks and made it, particularly as time went on, harder for newer players to get into.
There was lots of broken stuff in multiclassing. I mean, there was a lot of broken stuff in 3 and 3.5 anyway. And multiclassing just kind of added on to that. And that's actually the risk with multiclassing in 4E, is that there's so many, you know, you want to have combinations of powers between players, but not where one player has all of it. So you wouldn't want a multiclass Avenger thief who is able to roll 2 die every time he goes and can crit on 17, 18, 19, and 20. Or 18, 19, and 20. You know, you wouldn't want these combos that are, and they're already there. There's a lot of times where people are able to figure out the combos with just slight tweaks to multiclassing.
Yeah.
And I think there's a dichotomy, though. The problem is that players want broken stuff. They like to have they're looking for the ultimate efficiency. And I'm talking kind of power gamery stuff. I mean, there's certainly not all players that are like this, but there are some players who really enjoy finding those combination of abilities that can break the game.
So they can win.
Right. And it's fun for them to find it, and they get very bored of it if it happened consistently. But when you have a tank that's able to lock something down and keep it locked down and not have to roll attack rolls to do it, and there is no saving throw, they get a charge out of that. And you know, it's but then there's DMs like me who want to make sure that never happens. So mm-hmm. it's a hard balance. I don't like multiclassing, but I mainly see it on the DM side, where it's already hard enough for me to figure out what characters are going to do, and now it's even doubly hard when now they're multiclass sorcerer paladin, and I just don't understand how they work. But some players really dig it, so who's to say?
My rogue warlock was pretty easy. If she had her little wand out, that meant she was going to be doing warlock stuff. She had her dagger.
I love it.
But I mean, there were multi-classing things before where multi-class sorcerer rogue that was getting super high crits on ranged magic attacks because there wasn't anything written in that said dagger master didn't count if it was an implement.
Right. Yeah, there are going to be people who are going to go for as much optimization out of the combinations as they can. And there are going to be other people who actually do want... I mean, if you look at a lot of characters in story, they do kind of have a multi-class thing going on. Like, very few characters only do one of these archetypes, and that's it, in my experience. It gets harder with... I mean, Ranger does have some spells now again and stuff like that, but I know I read D&D books where... there's a combination rogue wizard or assassin has a lot of magic abilities too. So it all depends. But my brother does not like 4E because he finds it too limiting, because he still cannot create his Dex Fighter that he had in second edition that he really loves.
Why can't you make a Dex Fighter?
I don't know. It's possible under... It might be possible under Essentials. I haven't seen it yet. The basic attacks still, I thought, trigger off strength.
Well, but there's one feat you can take. And then it,
yeah.
I think, was it an 8th level? Oh, no, it was a Paragon tier. So it was a level 11. What are they called? Slayer. That's all Dex, where she took melee training Dex, and... That means every point of Dex she has equals 2 points of attack and a point and a half on damage. And, you know, boy, she hit
hard. What level of feat is that? Something you take
it for first level? Level, yeah. You can take it right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wants.
That's how I built Chaz.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
and it means that you're just as good with a bow as you are with a sword, which is also really nice.
Yeah, well, he wants a whip, too. That's the other problem. Yeah,
you can do a whip.
So we're talking about Zorro, right?
I think so. Yeah, he hasn't told me exactly what he wants. But...
So that's very much a swashbuckling character, which you could also do with a rogue. as well.
Oh, no. No, you cannot, because that is not a fighter.
The Slayer is a fighter, though.
Yeah.
No, I know. I know. Yeah. But no, I told him. It's like, you want to play a rogue? And he's like, no, I don't.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, you're just getting caught up on names now. But yeah.
Semantics.
But I agree with you, Randall. I think there's enough classes out there that you ought to be able to find. And there's the amount of customization you can do just with feats is so great that you should really be able to build any kind of character that you want to build and not have to multi-class.
I think the hidden subtext for me was about story. And I think, like I said, there are a lot of players, like you were saying, Mike, they're power gamers, and they're trying to find the right combination to win the combat or to, you know, and that's, to me, and this is, I'm sure this is a very old, well, he's seen as an old school way of thought, but to me, that's not the way the game is really played. I mean, it's a role-playing game, and so you're not developing enough story behind that. Yeah, I'm going to get comments about that. Hate mail. Send it to Thad's account.
I'll give you a comment. About that. I mean, I just, my group's not like that. You know, my group, they like the story, but they want a pretty simple story. And what they really enjoy is combat. And part of that combat is they like to watch a combination work. I mean, it's like a Magic, Magic the Gathering game. They build a deck and they want to see the deck work. And that's what they're into. So I think 4E in particular is designed around that idea. It gave a lot of power and a lot of control over to the player instead of the DM.
Yeah, you're right about that. Absolutely. So, but it was me trying to burn down Twitter, and I got a few comments, and it was a laugh. So, but like I said, there's a little bit of, you know, there's always an underlying, you know, I don't try to just spew out stuff randomly very often. I just,
it's fun though.
It is fun. And if it gets people thinking, then I think I've done something then. Because then, you know, as long as people are thinking about it and speaking in a, you know, relatively civil manner, and I think people could tell from the tone in the comment and stuff that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't trying to poke sticks at people. I was just making people, trying to get people to start thinking about things. So, because again, when it comes to nerd rage, people fly off the handle and they don't think about what they're trying to say. And it's then you get into trouble, and then you say, "Oh, well, I didn't mean to say that, but that's how I took it." No, you know, and it's like, "Okay, stop." But anyway, next issue.
Who's got a topic?
Has anyone seen Battle LA yet?
Nope.
Nope.
Okay.
I don't go to the theater anymore.
Is it awesome?
I'm done with theaters.
I really liked watching it. I went right after PAX East and I saw it. I think there's a lot of really fun stuff in there in terms of some of the stuff we've been talking about with D&D, like having encounters have alternate goals than just killing all the monsters. Like there's this one where they're trying to get people off a bridge sort of thing. And there's a lot of time limited stuff in it. But one of the ones that I'm thinking through in my head how I would bring it into a game is that I mean, it's in the trailer that it's aliens attack. So I don't think there's any spoilers there.
Oh no. Aliens? No.
You just ruined the movie for us.
I know I did. One thing that's common in many movies where aliens attack is that you find one of the bodies and you start trying to find its weak points because it's not necessarily the same weak points that we would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think how you would bring that into a game because up until the point you discover the weak points, those monsters should seem stronger. In my mind, like the one way to scare people, in the game would be to have them be stronger, and then after they've found out some weakness in the monster, they get weaker.
Mm-hmm.
But how to do that at the gaming table is what I'm still trying to figure out. I think like you could start off with elites, and then once they figure it out, they all go to, you only use standards, or you could just give them like bonuses to their attack rolls, I think would be the easiest way to do it. Or because it's more fun to have them attack you than it is for them to for the players to miss.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's what I've been thinking about.
Hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, I do have a question about the movie. And without spoilers, is it true that they're saying that there's a lot of it that's really like Black Hawk Down?
Yes.
Okay. Because I enjoyed that movie, and it was a good movie. And there's,
So I went to the movie with somebody who had been in the military, and there was a lot of things that he said rang really true to him about the movie and his experience having been in the military. So if that helps.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So it was kind of, they even, you know, made sure that a lot of the buttons and stuff were right. I don't know if all of them were, but it felt very authentic to him.
So Tracy, do you want suggestions, or are you're just saying that you were sort of mulling that over? And
you guys can suggest too. I've been thinking of writing an article about it. If I take any of your ideas, I will give you credit.
Well, I like the idea of time limits. In fact, without showing my hand too much, the encounters adventure that I sent to Wizards for their encounter contest, it's a timed encounter. So if you don't do certain things within a certain time frame and a number of rounds, then bad stuff happens. So, but I think that's an element that's lacking in some things. It happens a lot in video games, but not as common in role-playing adventures that I've seen. So there are some, but you know, I don't mean that as a general statement, but just.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's that sense of urgency tends to be more written in as a story element than a mechanical element. Something like, oh, we've got to get to this place by this time, but it's rarely expressed in terms of number of rounds or whatever that you need to do it in. Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking more in terms of the how do you show the players that them figuring out a weakness is actually an advantage in the game. Like, you know, if they take the time to investigate a creature that they've never seen before or never heard of, and they learn about some weakness, how do you mimic that knowledge as an advantage in the game? So what I'm thinking is, when you think about how creatures are protected or how they take damage, you know, you can give them some, you can either do it on the creature side or the player side, right? So you could say these creatures, if the players don't know about their weak spot, then the creatures have across the board a damage reduction 10 or something. Or, you know, resistance 10 or whatever. Or you could do it from the player side where you say, well, once they have that knowledge, you do it as though the creature is vulnerable to their attacks. So once the fighter understands, you know, that it's that one spot on Smaug's underbelly that's the weak spot, then when he attacks, then he gets it as though Smaug is vulnerable to his attack. So you can do like a vulnerable 15 once that knowledge is known by any particular character or something like that. If you don't want to give them, you know, bonuses. Because the danger is if you give them, oh, well, once you know this knowledge, you get a +4 to attack. If they roll a 2, then, you know, that knowledge didn't help them, you know. And then sort of a anticlimactic when if they roll really poorly 4 or 5 times in a row, like my players did in the game last night, you know, then having a +2 or a +4 isn't really all that helpful because, you know, they rolled a 1. That sort of also depends on level because if you get up into the higher levels, rolling a 1, you're still, you know, that's still a +15 to hit. And if you gave them a +4, that's a 19, you know, it's still rolling a 1 though. So I don't know. So that's sort of what I'm thinking of is how do you mimic that knowledge? Well, you can either give the players a bonus or you can start with a huge amount of resistance and then take away that resistance once the players have the knowledge, or you can give them vulnerabilities that the players can exploit. You know, yeah. Maybe the knowledge that they find, the weakness is, oh, well, this creature isn't normally, you know, vulnerable to fire, but if you, you know, if you hit it with lightning first, then it's vulnerable to fire or something. And then them knowing that will allow them to exploit that. And then it's more specific.
Right.
So,
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is you can set up the skill challenge with you can set it up as a skill challenge for them learning the creatures, more about the creatures, and then and it's timed, like there's something else going on that they can only do this quickly and then have to leave, and then how far they progress in that time will give them different amounts of bonuses. And then I think the other thing is just that a lot of these movies just have this initial, like, there's nothing we can do to stop these things, and then over time you gain that knowledge and they become and like this doesn't necessarily have to be something that they even realize. Like, I wonder if you start off with using mostly elites and then over time you mix in a lot more standard creatures so that you know, one or two, maybe three hits are killing them. I think that I wonder how that plays out at the table with the knowing that the players are also the audience for the story.
So in as far as a campaign goes, I think that could really be effective, because if let's say this encounter with these particular creatures is going to take place over three PC levels, right? And so when they first encounter them, of course, they're going to be completely overwhelmed, and they're probably not going to fare very well in that encounter. But the thing is, if it takes place over a long period of time and the PCs level up, they might just attribute their ability to then best those creatures as the fact that they leveled up and got more powerful, rather than that their knowledge was helpful. So you'd have to be, you'd have to pay attention in terms of how you're presenting it in the actual campaign. If it's one or two encounters, then yeah, you can completely show the difference very dramatically over, you know, two encounters in three different sessions or something like that. But if it's over a longer term, they might just attribute it to the fact that they've just become more powerful and leveled up.
Right.
I think to some extent you can nullify that by not only changing the how powerful the creatures are, but the numbers of creatures. If you have one of these creatures to start with, and he gives the players all that they can take, I mean, maybe even take it up from an elite and make it a solo to start with. And then towards the end of this campaign arc, when they've really gotten everything under control, they're fighting, you know, five or six of those. I think then you can you get a better sense that it's not just the levels that are influencing the how easy they are to beat now. It's something more than that. I mean, you still might have to really kind of play it up to the players to really emphasize that it's not just about the numbers, and that's why they're starting to win. But I think if you go from something one very strong monster to many to several less more average monsters, I think that progression feels more natural.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Now, Sam, it seems to me that part of your issue is that as to how to reveal that knowledge of the monster's vulnerability, to me that is built somewhat into the story itself. For example,
I didn't have a problem with that. My issue was letting them know that actually going through the role playing and taking the time to figure out that weakness actually does have a big effect, right? More so than just saying, oh, now that you know this, you have a +2. I think that's a little generic way to do it. So it could be effective if you're only going to meet these creatures one other time. But if you do the thing like what they're talking about, where you know you start with the creature that may be the level of a solo, and then eventually drops down to elite, but now you might meet more of them or whatever, then it makes that knowledge worthwhile. No, I it's a total story thing for me. I would, you know, and even if you had it be like a skill challenge at the beginning of a combat to learn that weakness, it still could be role played fairly well.
I was thinking of making it even more organic than that. For example, if you're using creatures that are using a lot of fire motif stuff, they're cast on fireballs, they've got fire auras, a player might reason, uses a lot of fire, maybe he's vulnerable to frost attacks. And since ahead of time you've already built in a vulnerability 5 frost or whatever, cold, then as soon as that player hits it with the cold, and you tell, wow, the cold seems to do a lot of damage or whatever, then they realize, oh, this creature is vulnerable to cold. And, well, that's a very basic dichotomy, fire and cold like that. You could also do something like if maybe it's vulnerable to something more esoteric, like thunder or sound. Mm-hmm. You know, you clang against something, or maybe a fighter misses an attack, and it clangs on something, and then the monster winces in pain at the sound, and then the players can pick up, oh, maybe it's vulnerable to thunder sound attacks or whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are the kinds of things that I was or how I would handle those kind of situations probably. But you're right. I mean, it's certainly a skill challenge or something like that would work too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, even – I mean, for me, I probably wouldn't actually do a skill challenge. If I was going to build a whole sort of half arc or something on them – figuring out how to defeat these new creatures that no one's ever heard of, or at least gain a better understanding of them, there would be a lot of role-playing in there for them to actually capture one and, you know, find its weakness by what we do in science. You know, they might dissect it or, you know, try to just learn more about it or whatnot. And, you know, so that would be really, you know, more role-playing there rather than just pure skill challenge even. So anyway, exactly. Twitter questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
I've got a good one.
Yeah, you've got better ones than I got. So
so this is what I'm very curious about. And I'll kind of combine two questions. This one is from Digital Draco. And his question was, how long do you spend prepping for your games and how long do your games last? I'm very interested in like how people prep for their games and how long it takes them to prep from their games. So, Aaron, how do you do it?
Well, let me make sure my mic is turned on. I actually spend a lot of time on prep. I can't say in terms of number of hours per week, because that kind of depends on the scenario that I'm looking that's upcoming in the game. If it's a heavy combat game that's coming up, I honestly spend a lot less time on prep than I do if I'm anticipating a lot of investigation or role playing or that sort of thing. The more fuzzy sort of gameplay. If I'm expecting that, I'll prep two or three combats, and that usually takes me maybe an hour, hour and a half, if that, depending on if I have to change the monsters around. But for a role playing oriented scenario, I'll spend a lot of time during the week on it. I'll write NPCs up. I'll, you know, give them a basic physical description, some personality, that sort of thing, and that tends to take a lot of time. It probably takes, I know, 6 or 7 hours. Again, it depends on the scenario that I'm looking that's coming up. In terms of how long I play every week, I tend to aim for 3 to 4 hours at a session. If I go that far, I mean, if it ends up being less, that's fine. But that's generally what I'm aiming for in any given session.
Tracy, how about you?
We usually play during the week, so it's 2 to 3 hours. And I will do anywhere. Well, are we counting the time when I dream about my game?
If you wake up and immediately write it down, then yes, it's part of your prep.
Okay. Well, without the dreams, it's usually an hour and a half to 2 hours for every hour of the game. Because I do a lot of story and I do a lot of rewriting of it. And then I often dream about my game and then wake up and just rewrite everything. I dream in Dungeons and Dragons.
Randall?
I do a lot of advance work for the campaign so that it's fairly immersive, and I'm a prop horse, so I have to spend that time making things, physical objects and stuff like that. So that takes quite a bit of time, but that's all advance work, even before the players meet for the first time. And so, you know, weeks working on that stuff. And then once I start playing, I use a lot of drop-in adventures and like 2 hours tops and I'm ready to go. And I've used digital tools to manage the table for like initiative and things like that. So I literally have to just, all those monsters are all set up ahead of time. I just plug them in and we go. And so that part of it doesn't really take me that much time. And as I progress, as the campaign progresses, you know, an hour here to a week at the office or at home, you know, just writing different stuff up and things like that. So it's a kind of a staggered process, but Most of the campaign work is done in advance, so I have it and ready to go.
Do you post pictures or anything like that of the props that you put together?
I have. If you pour through the archive on my site, I've posted some things about counters and things like that I've created and used in the past. So, but I do from time to time. Absolutely.
That's cool.
Yeah, and Damn. I use cards and things like that. So, yeah.
So my face-to-face sessions go for about 4.5 hours. Of course, half hour of that is our chit-chat in the beginning before the actual game starts. And for prep, well, it sort of depends. I'm kind of like Randall in that I do a lot of prep before the campaign starts, and I sort of sketch out the different paths that the PCs could choose to go in, and I really lay out the sort of my first vision of what the main couple of villains are and, you know, what I can imagine their demise might be and what their motivations are. And of course, those things change throughout the campaign. They don't stay static. Mm-hmm. But for each individual session, it can vary from just, you know, a half hour because I just either didn't get in a lot of time or I did extra prep the week before. And sometimes it's just a half hour because most of it might be on the fly because it's a lot of role playing. And I've already set out the sort of main motivations of the NPCs and I know kind of what information is going to have to be relayed to the characters. But more often it's closer to 2 to 3 hours of prep for each session, over several days, you know, half hour here, an hour there. Mostly just for the combats, it doesn't take that long because I really try to get a good idea and a good sense of only keeping really important combats in the game, and I know my players pretty well now, so I can do that pretty easily. I don't know if I think I'm about average in terms of how much time I spend. It's more overall average. I spend more time prepping than actually gaming, and I think that's pretty common.
So I just answer the question myself. I probably spend about 5 or 6 hours a week for each game. My game is actually pretty short. I run a 3-hour game on Wednesday nights, and we start at 7:30, and I like to get everybody out by, you know, just before 11 if I can, usually 10:30 or 11. So I have to keep it pretty fast. I do a lot of the same tricks. I'm not yet able to dream in D&D as much as I'd like. I still dream about, you know, not missing a class in college and getting fired from my job and things like that. But one thing I do like to do is this is a trick I've picked up, you know, writing fiction, is that I like to close my eyes and imagine myself in the eyes of my antagonist and saying, okay, what is he doing right now? What's he thinking? Where is he going? Why does he think he's right? Why does he think he's a good guy? And, you know, that really helps kind of move my story and the adventure in the direction that I want to go. But I use Dwarven Forge for my map layout, so that takes like a good hour and a half or 2 hours. Probably takes an hour to clean up last week's game, put all that stuff away, and then put out next week's game.
Such a burden you have there. Like,
well,
yeah,
with your Dwarven Forge.
Sorry. Yeah. Besides being ridiculously expensive, it's also takes time to set up, but it makes some really awesome environments. And now they expect it. Like now it's like, you mm-hmm. know.
Oh, yeah. They get spoiled real quick.
If I put a dungeon tile out there, they're like, what the hell is that? Come on.
Yeah.
So.
This encounter is meaningless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lately, the thing that's been taking a lot of my time in encounter design is I've decided that every encounter I build is going to have a Dave the Game out. So every nice. Encounter has to have a way for them to short circuit the battle so they don't have to sit there and finish it out. So now my encounters take a little bit longer to design because I'm always kind of designing around that idea. And I think it works really well. I think the encounters are a lot better for it. But it does take a little bit more time.
All right, okay. Next question.
Next question comes from D&D Princess Aria, who asks, and this is, I thought, was a good question. How do you guys deal with parties with no healers? Sam, you want to go first on that one?
Actually, I'm typing the question, so no, I do not go first.
Okay.
Sorry.
Then, Tracy, how about you?
Well, we haven't really had that yet.
Okay.
I guess I would give some healing potions as loot.
Simple enough.
I don't know. Screw them.
Aaron?
threaten the players until they make a healer and make my life easier. No, seriously, like Tracy said, I'd probably add in a lot more magical healing items, like healing potions or magic items that have a healing daily power or whatever. I'd probably use monsters that didn't do quite as much damage. I mean, you can't, you know, nerf them completely or you take all the challenge out of it, but at the same time, with no healing, a little damage goes a lot farther, or at least it feels that way to the player. So I'd probably dumb it down just a little bit in that respect.
Hey, we could put save points in.
Yeah, that's a topic for a whole nother time, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Mike, how about you?
Kill them.
Yep.
No.
Let them see the folly of their ways.
Right. One trick that we had. So I actually had the opposite problem most of the time, which is that I had two people that pick leaders, and trying to do anything remotely considered challenging to a six-person group with two leaders, you know, is very difficult. So that's where you throw like ongoing 30 damage environmental effect that they can't resist, mm-hmm. and just happens all the time. That gets their attention. But one thing that I like to do is I like to let my tweaky. I have one player who just likes making characters and he likes building tweaked out characters. And I told him that he can just switch stances and go to the other build as like a, you know, with a full rest. So if he decides when he wakes up in the day, he says, I can be a bard or I can be I can be a warlord or I can be a fighter. And he gets to choose which, you know, is he going to be a fighter today or is he going to be a warlord today? And that way, if we're missing a leader, he can switch and be the leader. And his character is the same. Like, his character's story and everything else is the same, only now he's just swinging harder with the sword and not paying attention to other people. So we did that in my epic game, and that worked out really well. I suppose you could do the companion character, but I don't know how well a healer companion character would work.
Yeah.
I guess I would want to know too why they don't have a healer. Like, is it that just nobody wants to play that character class? I might treat that differently from someone who just said, hey, we could really use another striker instead.
I have a problem in my game that I selected what classes they're allowed to play in my Dark Sun game, and the first thing I did was eliminate all the PHB1 classes, and that got rid of the warlord. And the problem is that Dark Sun already gets rid of all the divine. So right. it meant that there was like 16 fighter classes or 16 striker classes and four leaders. And the leaders are all a little tweaky. You know, they're not all straightforward. So people seem to like bards.
Yeah.
But that makes it particularly challenging for that game. And that's my own limitation. And I really wish the Essentials Warlord stuff would come out. They keep saying it's going to come out soon.
What about moving a second wind to a minor and then a free for the dwarves?
So I didn't actually answer the question yet, but I'll Sorry? Jump in right there because that's actually something I've done. Because to be honest, I don't really do a whole lot. If they choose to not have a healer, well, they chose to not adventure with somebody who has that power. I mean, I don't intentionally make it more difficult for them, but I also don't intentionally usually make it more easy, quote unquote easy for them. I have tried the second wind as a minor, and it was okay. I didn't feel that it imbalanced anything or anything like that. It worked fine. I don't think that they felt that it took the place of what a healer character would have been able to do, but you know, I suppose subconsciously I probably tweaked the encounters a little bit so that it was a little less hard on them, but I didn't do it purposefully or to any great extent, you know. I mean, that's just the way it goes, right? Mm-hmm. Go find a cleric to adventure with.
Well, I have two answers. The first one is the smart aleck answer is like, well, their stuff resets every day anyway, so big deal. Mm-hmm. That's the smart ass answer. That's the angry DM answer. No, I'm just kidding. But the other one is probably a combination of what Tracy said. Throw in some extra, you know, healing potions in there every now and again. Or, I mean, the one campaign has my players, six group of players. I've got a pally, but he likes to pretend he's a DPS pally and not a, which he's not, but doesn't tend to do a lot of the healing. And so far, they haven't had much issue with it. So we had a warlord, but he's gone and was replaced by a tank that, like, every hit he makes gives him temporary hit points. So he, like, never needs healing. So so it's kind of it's almost a non-issue, which it's kind of odd, but maybe I'm not being – maybe I'm too soft. So I don't know. But time will tell as they get further in level to see what that really looks like. But
yeah. Next question.
I've got one question here that I like, which is this is from Digital Draco. So he gets two questions tonight, I guess. What do you do if you've got very little or nothing planned? Do you call the game or do you improvise? And I would extend that to, if you improvise, what are your tricks for improvising a game? Sam, do you want to start, or do you want Randall to start?
I'm typing again, so sorry.
Randall, go ahead.
I can start. It's role playing night, and so what we do is I usually come up with some kind of quirky NPC, and that would usually run the characters around, making them do stupid stuff, and of course my wife's sitting here next to me, and she's going, "Oh crap, that's what he's doing," and. but to get some interesting interplay going between the characters, maybe throw in a couple of interesting decisions for them to make. Nothing devastating or breaking. Just to keep things interesting and lively, and that's all you really need to do. Especially if you're caught that unawares. I'm usually not caught that unawares, but that's me. So, but that's what I would normally handle it.
Tracy.
I usually always have time to do some sort of encounter, so that's my fallback. And then it's just a matter of enticing them to the encounter, or we just do role-playing. I have occasionally called the game and not had it, but that had more to do with some of the problems our previous group had that I don't think we have in the new one.
What did you find yourself in any situations at PAX where you had to come up with stuff really quickly?
Never. Oh, I mean, the learn to plays were totally like that.
What did you find? Like when you were, I think I saw you at one point where you just had your head down. I even took a picture of it and put it on Twitter, where it was like 5 minutes before a group was going to show up at your table, and your head was down and you were cramming. Where do you find your attention going when you need to? You know, you have 5 minutes to get a game ready for a group of six strangers that's about to sit down at your table.
At that point, I try to figure out, we kind of had that with the learn to play. I figured out they were going to fight the dragon at the end, and then I quickly got together the kobold minions, because that works really well with new players.
Yeah.
They like being able to kill those minions, and then just quickly come up with a story. And that's when you rely a lot on, you know, the books you've read or the movies you've seen. Because not only does that help you, because you've seen the story before, you know how it goes, the players can hold on to it pretty easily without a lot of hints.
How about you, Aaron?
Well, since I plan my campaign fairly far in advance, I'm never completely caught off guard in terms of prep. So I usually have some idea of what I can do. I might call the session short. I mean, like I said earlier, I usually plan for three or four hour games, but I might go, okay, we're only going to be here for a couple hours tonight because I don't have a lot ready. I also tend to have in my combat manager, I have a lot of different monsters, so I can throw together an encounter really quickly. So in that case, I'll ask for a few minutes from the players and say, just give me a few minutes. I'll throw something together really quick, draw something on the mat. And, but it really helps that I plan I plan in advance for what my story is going to be, what the characters are going to go through for the next few sessions. So even if I don't have something specific planned for the night, I've got an idea of where I'm going anyway, and that makes it a lot easier to improvise and do something on the fly.
Sam?
I have something of a mix between what Randall and Aaron said, in that because I sit down at the beginning of a new campaign arc and I sort of, you know, sketch out an outline or a flow chart, so to speak, although I'm not a railroader, so it's not truly a flow chart. Or maybe it's a flow chart with lots of branches. How about that? It's relatively easy for me to just spend 10 minutes and come up with enough for a whole session. And in fact, I didn't used to be like that. I used to be a DM that would plan and plan and plan and plan and plan, and I had to prep a whole ton. And a couple, two or three times it happened where I just did not have the time to prep. And one of those times was probably one of the best sessions I've ever run, because I just went by the seat of my pants, and I gained a lot of confidence from that, because it was suddenly like, oh, you know, I didn't have to do all that prep, and I could still pull off a really fun session where everyone really enjoyed themselves and everybody had a lot of fun. And so at that point, I sort of morphed my DMing style into, rather than having, you know, a whole, you know, giant information folder for each NPC, I would have, you know, sort of a couple of things that are their motivations and a little bit of stats to sort of say what they're really good at, and a couple of sentences of backstory, and that's pretty much it. And with that, I can have, you know, three NPCs, and we can have an entire, you know, gaming session of interaction with NPCs. You know, it's, I don't know how it would be if I didn't do the prep at the beginning of the campaign arc, but I've sort of relaxed a lot on my prep lately, and, you know, my players say that they have a lot of fun. So, you know, I don't really have any tips or tricks other than always have a list of names.
If
someone goes somewhere that you weren't expecting them to go, you know, then you need to have some list of names of people that they might meet there. Have a list of cities, have a list of, you know, different rumors maybe that they could hear about in an area, just totally generic, you know. And then you don't have to go, what's that guy's name? You can just look down at your piece of paper and say, this is so-and-so. And then they're like, oh, man, that was planned. Oh, we were supposed to meet this person, you know. And, you know, of course, now they don't, because they just listen to this and and they know. But in fact, one of my players said that a few weeks ago. He said, oh, now that I know you make these lists, I'm not as worried when we meet somebody and you immediately know their name. So, but yeah, so those are the kind of the tips, right? Just have a list of names and have a list of, you know, even if they go to a city that you've never been to, just, I have this page and it has a list of names of people they might meet, a list of stores they might happen by, a list of all the taverns in the place, taverns and inns, and a list of the noble people who run the place, basically, in case they ask, right? And you can get through an entire session like that if you can think on your feet.
Oh, yeah. And if I can add on... go ahead. Sorry, Aaron.
If I can add on to that, if you're really caught off guard and you don't have those lists, but you have internet access, there are generators. There are name generators. There are tavern generators. Mm-hmm. If you can spend a couple of minutes to get online, you can pull up a list of whatever you might need. So in case you're really caught off guard with that.
I'm probably not particularly good at it, but I've at a couple of cons, I've had like zero prep, and I tend to grab like a published adventure, and I will, in one case, I think I had a published adventure where they were going into a bunch of caverns to fight some ants, and I turned it into a 3-ring arena battle against gladiators. Mm-hmm. And it just shows how reskinnable 4E is, that it really takes nothing to turn a giant ant into a gladiator, you know, just reflavor some of the powers and you're all set.
Right.
And so kind of grabbing, I mean, the Dungeon Delve, I can't believe they don't make another Dungeon Delve, because I think it's still one of my favorite books. But the Dungeon Delve kind of gives you all the maps and stuff, and the Monster Vault gives you all the monsters, so you can kind of build, you know, if you had no prep, you could probably whip one of those together pretty quick. Mm-hmm. I think
As designed, I think, too.
Yeah, probably right. I think so. I mean, I think you still have to kind of redo all the math for it, but at least you have a layout.
Right.
Tracy's idea of kind of picking a movie or a story, I love doing that. I love taking, like, I still love 1 hour dramas or you know, some movie, and I say, okay, I'm just going to base it on that. I had a no prep adventure that I ran at Gen Con a couple years back that I based on The Big Lebowski. And
sweet.
It ran really well. And that was, you know, you can put little tricks in there, like making, you know, having one of the players betray the others without anybody knowing who it's going to be and stuff like that. So yeah, I think there's a lot you can do to kind of run an adventure with almost no prep. And I plan to steal the idea and make it a Sly Flourish article. So thank you all for
it really is a big confidence builder. If you're a person who is used to a crap ton of prep and you get forced into a situation, it's sort of the same way that running for strangers at a con is a confidence builder, because if it goes well, you know, you just did a gauntlet, right? You just ran a game for people you don't know and it went well, and that's awesome. And it's a big confidence builder. It's the same if you run a game even for people that you know and you didn't have any prep. And if it goes well, you know, it's just a huge confidence builder. And at the same time, if it doesn't go well, it's sort of like, well, you know, so what could I do to improve it, or what could I change, or what could I think of that might make it easier if this ever happens again? And then it becomes a learning experience, and that's still a win.
Yeah, one other thing I forgot to mention is that the DM screen, either from the DM kit or the new DM screen, is a very vital aid in, you know, running an adventure with nothing. If I can be so presumptuous as to provide a shameless plug, the DM cheat sheet that I have on my website has all the math for creating monsters, you know, applying damage and having all the DCs on a 5x8 card. And, you know, I made it because I wanted one, and I find it really useful.
Well, and I think that's a good segue. Let's go into the pimp what you're doing round. What do you say? Before we wrap up.
Sounds good to me.
Yep, do it.
Okay.
Randall, what are you working on?
Okay. Well, I just finished another post on Star Frontiers for This Is My Game. I finally did the classes, so go check it out. MyRPGame.net. So that's what I've been working on.
Well, the same site, This Is My Game, has a review of my adventure up there. I should check that out, both the adventure and the review. Both pretty good. That's most of what I've been doing, and then recovering from PAX East and getting sick.
Aaron, what are you doing?
I'm slacking. I'm not really doing anything. I'm basically doing my Gen Con prep, trying to figure out what games I want to run there. So I'm doing long-term preparations, nothing short-term. At the moment,
awesome.
I'm being killed by Sam in his game. That's what I've been up to.
Isn't that what the DM's supposed to do? I mean, yeah. At least it's fun. Mike, what are you doing?
I'm really trying to emulate my hero Robert Schwab, only without the beer. And so I've got a lot of different things, but I'll be quick. Of course, my new book, Sly Flourishes, Running Epic Tier D&D Games, is available at slyflourish.com/epic. There was a review on NWorld that was pretty good, and then people have been picking it up and enjoying it. So I like it. I'm pretty happy with it. I just posted I think I mentioned it before, the published adventure for my DM challenge is up on slyflourish.com. I have another one as well, a Gamma World adventure that I thought I was going to run as a DM challenge before I found out how structured it was, called The Dark Freighter. Tracy and I actually had a conversation about it, and I took our conversation and turned it into a Gamma World adventure that I really liked, and I ran it twice at PAX, and I think it went really well. What else? I have a series of three articles I'm writing for DDI. One of them, I'm, and hopefully they will actually be published there, but in any case, I am writing them. The first one is written and turned in and has been through all the process, so hopefully it'll show up there soon. The second one, I am sending the draft in before the end of the month, and the third will probably be the month after that. And they are monster makeovers, so I get to kind of pick a monster that I like and rebuild it and make it better than it originally was. So that's awesome. Something I've cool. always wanted to do. And last, next Monday, I have the Gaming Convention Survival Guide that I'm publishing to SlyFlourish.com with tips and tricks for how to survive a con. I figure now I've been to about 5 or 6 cons, and I've learned a lot of little tricks. And I'll give you an example of one little trick, which is everybody always goes to the fancy restaurants and the hotels. And they're expensive, and they're very hard to get into because there's like 11,000 people trying to get one of the 8 tables. And half the trick is something that I learned, and the other half is it was given to me by Phil Menard, the chatty DM, which is call ahead and order your food to go and then walk right in and pick it up. And you can sit right outside of the restaurant at one of the many tables that are right outside and eat right outside and not have to wait in line at all. And that was a really cool trick. So I have a whole bunch of these that I put together, and I'm putting in an article on my website. And cool. I
look forward
that's
to that.
About it. Yeah.
All right. Tracy, you had something else?
I was just going to say that I did an interview with Wolfgang Bauer from Open Design and Cobalt Quarterly for the Tome Show that I think was really good. Matt James on that one, too.
Tracy, did you pimp your adventure?
Kind of. I pimped the review of my adventure.
I bought it, and I like it very much. I look forward to loving it.
I did, too.
Randall, did you buy it?
I haven't bought it yet. I read a preview of it. I got a sneak preview of it, and I liked it. I did.
So you stole
it. I just haven't bought it yet. No, because I haven't used it. Stealing it implies that I used it. Yeah,
but I still paid for it.
Mike, I haven't bought your books either. So,
oh no,
because I am a cheap bastard. Okay.
Yeah. So,
$4.
Gee, Sam. God. Sam, what are you working on? In order to quit this huge rage fight that's about to happen between Mike and Randall, I'll tell you what I'm working on.
Nothing but love for you, Mike. Nothing but love for you.
Buy my book.
Yeah.
Put the money where the mouth is, Randall. Come on.
I know. I gotta own up. Go ahead, Sam. Sorry.
I just wrote a post about moral dilemmas in your game on RPGMusings.com, and I've gotten a lot of good feedback from it. So I hope that people go there and read that and learn a lot of good stuff and pull it away and use it for your game and play with it. And I'm running my games regularly again after the huge holiday hiatus. And I'm having a lot of fun with that, and that's all I'm going to pimp right now. So, I do want to pimp that episode of the Tome Show that Tracy just mentioned. It's episode 169. It's a really good episode with Matt James and Wolfgang Bauer. So
sweet.
All right. And now we're going to quit recording. So everybody say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Good one. Goodbye.
Goodbye.